Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. So start getting your best night's sleep in sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. And you can try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee, plus 15% off your first order with code BUTTERY. So head to bollandbranch.com today. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
Hello and welcome to Caged In Presents Coppola Connections, as always brought to you by the Breadcrumbs Collective and hosted by me, Petros Patsilivas, your friendly guide through the crazy world of the Coppola family tree. What do I mean by that, I hear you ask? Well, if this is your first time and you have no idea what I'm talking about, well, here on this podcast, we watch every single film in the collective Coppola family filmography to determine, are they the greatest film family of all time? But how we do that is we watch one film at a time. And is that enough to put them in that Hall of Fame as the greatest film family of all time? And I'm always joined by a guest, and this week is no different. I am joined by the lovely David Rosen from the Piecing It Together podcast, a fantastic podcast that, yeah, I was lucky enough to be a guest on, and maybe a guest on again soon. It's a great format. David explains all about that, and he joined me to talk about the 2015 slacker comedy by Bob Byington, Seven Chinese Brothers. We get all into that in this episode. It is a lot of fun. As is always the case, we talk about this this film in spoilerific detail, all 84 minutes of it. We talk about it in the nitties and the gritties, so if you haven't seen it, go source it out, go check it out. It's a lot of fun. So yeah, once you've done that, come back and listen to me and David get into this film. So all that's left to do is to stumble your way through life with your dog companion, try not to get fired from your job at the Quick Lube, and settle your beef with your old rivals from your job at Bupe de Beco as we make some Coppola connections. Today, we're slacking our way through life with Bob Byington's 2015 comedy drama, Seven Chinese Brothers. Film stars Olympia Dukakis, Tunde Adepimbe, Eleanor Pienta, Stephen Root, and today's Coppola connection, Jason Schwartzman. Joining me to go bar hopping as I pretend to be from the Deep South and he pretends to be a doctor, and to help me determine if the Coppolas are the greatest film family of all time, is a man who is far from being a slacker. It's composer and host of the Piecing It Together podcast, David Rosen. How are you, sir?
I am doing great, and I'm excited to talk about this movie.
Yeah. I'm excited as well. I've got to admit to you, this is one that kind of, until I came to this, like, kind of looking through all of the Coppola family films, escaped me. So it's nice when people kind of turn me on to stuff, and it's interesting that the last Jason Schwartzman film that was covered on the podcast would have been Listen Up Philip, which this film very much feels like it's bedfellows with.
Sure.
Well, before we get into talking about Seven Chinese Brothers, tell us a little bit about your podcast.
Yeah, sure. Well, piecing it together, my podcast, which you have, of course, been a guest on before. But what we do is we take a look at new movies through the lens of what other movies might have inspired it. And so we will end up, during the course of a conversation, end up with a big list of other movies that either explore similar themes or are made in similar styles, just some kind of connections that we can put together between those movies and the movie that's being featured. And you end up with a great list by the end, a great conversation to listen to. And it's a fun, different way to discuss a movie. And we've been going 5 years now, and I just love talking about movies this way. It leads to all kinds of new connections.
Yeah, and it definitely, I found, it makes you watch films for a different lens, right? I guess movie watching for you, even if it's not for the podcast, you're there kind of going, here's the puzzle pieces, kind of like as whatever you watch. Is that a bit of this? Is that a bit of that? Like, yeah, has it ruined movies for you somewhat?
A little bit. I mean, it's certainly ruined all my free time, I'll tell you that much. But, you know, yeah, I'm always, even the movies that I don't plan on covering, I usually will jot down a few thoughts on what would be a puzzle piece if I do end up covering this. And then more than likely we do cover it because what is free time?
Yeah, you know? Exactly. Yeah, instead of running away from the beast, embrace it. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm. That's right.
feed that kind of puzzle piece monster that's on your back.
Yeah.
So let's jump into talking about the Coppola family. And the first question I always like to ask on this podcast is, when you became aware of the Coppola family, and obviously like there must have been an entry point, but when did you kind of, yeah, what was that entry point? And when did you figure out like, oh, there's more than just that person, that there's this kind of whole spider's web of a family?
Yeah, sure. I mean, I grew up in the 80s. You know, I was born in 1980. And so, you know, The Godfather was on like every shelf. And, you know, just knowing the name Coppola is like, it's just synonymous with movies when you're a kid growing up. Even if you haven't seen those movies, uh-huh. you know they exist. I really feel like the first thing, I mean, we're all big Nicolas Cage fans around here. I think that the first like little tidbit that came to mind that was like, oh, there's a whole lot more to this family is when you find out, when you have that moment of discovery that, oh, Nicolas Cage is a part of this family. And then you're like, oh, wow, okay, so there's a lot of people involved.
Yeah. And then it's like, oh, Connie Corleone, like do you know what I mean? Talia Shire, she's a member of the family. And then like, I've had people on like, they go, my mind was blown when I realized that Adrian from Rocky's son was Jason Schwartzman. Yeah. And I was like, yes, hey, like it's kind of mind-boggling.
It's crazy. Yeah, and it's just layers and layers just keep peeling back. It's a wild ride.
I'm going to watch every single film they've ever made. So obviously, yeah, you live in the States, you live in Vegas, right? Have you ever met Coppola? Or have you ever seen anyone strolling down the strip? Have you said Nicolas Cage? He lives in your tax-free haven that is Las Vegas?
Yeah, he does live here. I unfortunately have not met him yet, though. I'm hoping it happens one of these days. The closest thing I have is I did see Rooney in concert and got to meet Robert Schwartzman at that show at the Beauty Bar here in Las Vegas. So that's the one in-person meeting that I have with anyone in this family, as far as I can recall, let's say.
That's amazing. I'm yet to dive into his kind of directorial work, because I know that like he's kind of moved away from the band and kind of directed a handful of films now, and he's doing some really great things in regards to distribution as well. I think he's got like a company called Utopia Movies that kind of like have created this new way of distributing movies in an interesting way.
Okay, yeah, I didn't realize that he had a hand in Utopia. I certainly have heard, you know, that name. I see it on a lot of things lately. Utopia is kind of all over the place in indie films, and I didn't realize that he had a hand in that.
Yeah. He's just recently had twins, so I guess he's probably like, take a back seat from the directing and the band stuff, maybe do something I can manage from home somewhat. Do you know what I mean? Like helping with distribution or whatever.
Absolutely. I might have met Jason Schwartzman once, but at the time I was doing a lot of drinking. I was working for Sony Music, and when Phantom Planet came out with Big Brat and all that stuff, and so I was at a lot of like promotional events, but those days are a bit of a blur.
Someone once said on the podcast like they're taking it. They met a Coppola because they watched Phantom Planet play once, so they breathed the same air as Jason Schwartzman. I was like, I'm taking that.
Close enough.
So what would have been, talking of Jason Schwartzman, what would have been the first Jason Schwartzman film you would have seen?
I feel like most people my age, it would be Rushmore. Uh-huh. And that, you know, that's it. I mean, there's probably something that I had seen before that point and like didn't, you know, connect the dots or realize, you know, that that's who that person is. But I think that's the movie that put him on a lot of our radar for people my age.
Yeah. Because I think he did that movie and then took a few years off of acting. So it was his first role. What a first role as well, right?
Yeah, it's a huge way to like debut yourself, even if he was around already. I don't know. Like, you know, I was a little like too young to fully appreciate it at the time when it came out, but my parents were pretty dialed into, you know, cool new movies and stuff like that. And they had heard so many, you know, good things about it out of whatever festivals or whatever it was. And so we all went as a family to see Rushmore, and it's Rushmore. It's great.
Yeah. A film that kind of, I don't know, in a way that has set the template for who Jason Schwartzman is, kind of.
Oh yeah.
In both aspects of his kind of creative work, whether that is kind of acting or kind of what he does behind the scenes, because it seems to be every Wes Anderson project has a story credit by Jason Schwartzman, even if that is him and Wes talk about the idea and Jason's there going, hey Wes, we chatted about it that one time, I'm gonna need that story credit.
Oh yeah
Jason and Roman, like, we're going to tell you some stories about the Coppola family. And then all of a sudden they got the Darjeeling Limited. It's like, come on, give us that writing credit, Wes.
Yeah, absolutely.
Let's talk about our main attraction for today, which is Seven Chinese Brothers. But before we do, let's listen to the trailer.
You literally sleep all day. You know, it's not good for you to get this much sleep. Open them.
Larry, did you happen to notice that we had some video surveillance equipment installed?
I don't know.
You're fired.
Why are you alone, for Christ's sake?
God.
Okay.
Nice meeting you.
Who's gonna dial 911 when you're gasping for air?
I'm teaching the dog how to do it.
I'm off in 20 if you want to go clubbing.
This is my imitation of a person from the South hearing a story that they like. Tell me about last night.
I went to Jim's last night.
Shut up.
But
no.
The door is locked.
No.
It's supposed to be a surprise party.
No, shut up.
So I checked my phone
shut
to see
up.
If I was
go
late.
Shut up, go away.
Did you key my car?
Yeah, I did. Never a good idea, keying someone's car. I feel like this is a new low. That sign says no hiring. So listen, are you hiring?
Yes. I'm gonna just need you to sign here.
All right. This pen doesn't work. Has anyone ever gotten fired on the first day?
You'll be running this place in no time, Lawrence.
1 second, my stocks are crashing.
You know how to do this by now, right, Larry?
I think so. Oh, boy. Usually I don't like my work. I tend not to, but I like my boss, so that makes it a place that I look forward to going to, which I've never had before, really.
Look, what's this?
Wait.
That's fat kid getting out of a pool. I'm gonna try to be a good or better person.
Are you awake?
I'm sorry I'm critical. I'm too critical. I'm hard on you. Did you know that if you're high-fiving somebody, if you look at their elbows, you will never miss with your hand? Focus on my elbow.
What?
One of the things I've started doing a lot more recently is asking my guests, like, do you think listening to that trailer, it sells the film as the film that it actually is?
I think it kind of does. And I had never seen or heard the trailer before. I came to this movie just as it's another movie from Bob Byington, the director. And so I just went ahead and watched it without knowing much about it. I just knew that it was him and Jason Schwartzman. But yeah, I think that the trailer does a pretty good job of selling like what it's all about and what it is. Maybe it's a little more upbeat than what it really actually is. Yes. But other than that, I think it's a pretty good representation.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. It kind of makes it seem like it's a laugh riot when it's a bit more kind of, I don't know, it's not in a disparaging way, but it's a bit more of a kind of low key film in a way. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's not kind of like a riotous, like laugh a minute kind of affair. It's kind of a bit more like subtle and kind of like gets under your skin as opposed to just being like, boom, here's a joke, great. And that song that plays in that trailer does not appear in the film at all. Like there is no kind of like upbeat kind of music like that. It's kind of more like The Cars and REM on the soundtrack.
Yeah.
So yeah, let's get some little stats and then we'll get onto your guest synopsis. So the budget for this film is unavailable. I couldn't find the budget for this anywhere, but did find the box office and it made $28,180. So imagine didn't recoup its budget. I'd imagine this film was not made for less than $28,000.
That's probably not much though, but yeah, but probably not that little.
the release date for this was the 28th of August 2015 in the US. I don't think it ever got kind of international distribution, at least not here in the UK. And it premiered at the South by Southwest Festival 2015. So David, like, can you tell us what Seven Chinese Brothers is about? What's the kind of synopsis to this film?
So I think this is basically a movie that kind of takes a little bit of like a nihilistic kind of everything is stupid approach to looking at a kind of lovable loser type guy who just kind of hangs out with his dog. He's on the verge of getting fired from his job when we first meet him. He gets another job, but he's not exactly moving up in the world in any particular way. He's just kind of floating through life. He visits his grandma. He has a couple of friends. He jokes about everything, but he's a loser basically. And he's a fun loving loser who doesn't really feel bad for himself. It's kind of the lot in life that he is accepted and seems to be okay with. And it's a little mumblecore-y. Like you said, it's not super laugh out loud, but at the same time, I find this movie to be very funny, possibly because I identify with the character a lot. But I mean, I just, this particular kind of worldview, I tend to identify with a lot. So it's like, if you kind of get that kind of worldview in your own personal life, I think you'll probably connect with it because the character is a lot of fun, but could also be insufferable depending on your point of view.
Yeah, that's something I really wanted to touch upon is kind of like, is Larry a likable character, Jason Schwartzman's character? And obviously, I guess it like, same thing kind of was talked about when talking about Listen Up Philip. It's like, a lot of reviews and like Letterboxd reviews I read for like that film in particular was like, yeah, it's okay, but like Jason Schwartzman was playing an insufferable prick. And it's like, I can imagine that being leveled at Seven Chinese Brothers as well, because it's kind of
right,
like from the get-go it's like he's, I don't know, just joking when there shouldn't be jokes. He's stealing from work like openly. Mm-hmm. He's kind of like he's a bit of a prick.
Yeah, and I think Schwartzman is great at this kind of a role. I mean, really, if you go back to Rushmore, that is also kind of his thing there as well. Yeah. I mean, I rewatched it for the first time in a while just recently, and that was a thing that stuck out to me. Like, you know, we all remember loving Schwartzman in Rushmore, but God, that kid is a pain in the ass, yes. You know? And so it's like, he really does do that really well. And whether or not you can, you know, sit with somebody like that for an entire movie's length, is going to really dictate how much you like the movie. And luckily the movie is pretty short too. So if you don't like that, you'll get through it quick.
Oh yeah. We're talking like, what is it? Like,
80 something, maybe?
Yeah, 84 minutes, if that. Yeah. I remember seeing the runtime and be like, Oh, David, thank you very much. I've had a lot of like two hour plus movies to watch recently, and this one was like, I could maybe watch that twice if. So, like, let's talk about some of like the earlier scenes in this film, and like, yeah, what do you like? Let's talk about that kind of that kind of opening of him kind of in the bar that he works at when he gets fired, like.
Which, by the way, it's a Buca di Beppo that he works at, which is hilarious because it's like, I don't know, it's just such a weird setting to see a movie take place. And I don't know if you have Buca di Beppos out
we
there.
We do not. No.
Yeah, it's like. I mean, you know, Olive Garden, I would imagine that's more of a, you know, name brand that everybody knows, but it's like, it's a step up, but not really from an Olive Garden, you know, it's like, and it certainly portrays itself as a step up, but it's not really. And it's just such a weird place for a character to be set.
Definitely. And like, you see in those scenes as well, like this kind of, I don't know, like his disdain he has for authority and stuff like that. And like, it is one of those things that I found myself being like, I've been this guy at a job, not the stealing aspect, but I've been this kind of, I don't really give a fuck. Like, I'm just going to make jokes all the time. Like, just going to be on, never going to be off, and kind of,
yeah,
the party, that being the fun loving guy is more important than the actual work. And I was like, I think I'm gonna like this film because of that. Because I'm honest with myself as well. Like, I think like that's the thing. If there's like insufferable characters in films, like 9 times out of 10, if you're kind of honest with yourself, it's like you probably can relate to that. Do you know what I mean? We've probably all had shades. I don't know. I don't know. Maybe not all of us kind of. It took me to have a kid to kind of knuckle down and start to take life seriously. But I can imagine if I hadn't had a kid, I could have been 34 thinking that working at Quick Lube is kind of like the be all and end all of like life.
Yeah, things are starting to go pretty well for me at the Quick Lube. But I came to this movie, I don't know if we're going to talk about that a little later, but through Bob Byington's other film, Francis Ferguson, which was my favorite movie of 2020, which nobody really seems to like. I don't know why, I just really connect with this guy's movies. But that also features a main character who has just a very, just everything is stupid, like kind of like a happy nihilistic kind of point of view, like just joking about everything the whole time, not taking anything seriously. A much worse character, if you're going to get into it, like what happens in that movie, but you know, still similar in that way of just joking about everything, a charming loser kind of, you know. And again, this same kind of character that if you connect with it in any way, you're going to really enjoy the movie. But if you find to be insufferable, you're just going to be like, you know, why is there a movie about a character like this? Why would I want to watch this character? So I don't know. Both these movies, they do kind of fit together really well.
Mm-hmm. And yeah, what was your kind of initial reaction when you first, when would you have watched this film, and what was your kind of first reaction when you saw Seven Chinese Brothers?
So yeah, I watched Francis Ferguson like right as the pandemic was starting. Uh-huh. It was a movie that technically came out in 2019, but literally was like dumped on streaming and like nobody saw it. Like maybe like 100 people in the world saw it. And then all of a sudden Amazon, they'd probably needed content for their front page during the pandemic to get people, you know, their minds off of how insane the world was and what was happening. And so there was all these like buried movies that came to the forefront. That's how I found that movie. Loved it so much that I started going back into other Bob Byington movies, and that's when I found Seven Chinese Brothers. So it was during the pandemic, during a big moment of realizing, oh wow, the world is so stupid. Like we're never going to get out of this. Like everything is just awful. But hey, I'm a generally happy guy. I like to joke about stuff, and so you know, maybe the world is shit, but I'll be okay. I'll be happy about it. You know, and that's what I see in these characters.
I'm looking at the cast list for that right now, and I'm excited. UK listeners, it is Francis Ferguson is streaming on Amazon Prime here in the UK as well. So Nick Offerman, Martin Starr, and David Krumholtz. I'm in. It's kind of nice. It's amazing these casts that, I don't know, like, yeah, I may be ignorant here, but Bob Byington is somebody like who kind of really slipped past me. And he's kind of like, I think like watching this film, he's an interesting director. He's obviously, he's not afraid to speak his mind. Like, I know when he was talking about Seven Chinese Brothers, he said like the reason he made this film was because he saw the Anthony Hopkins film from the, I don't know, like must have been like the 90s. Called Hearts in Atlantis, and was like, I hated it. It was like, I hated that film so much that I was like, I could write a story better than that, and then wrote this, and then kind of like had the story kicking around for like 15 years. He said,
a spite movie.
Yeah, he said in an interview as well. He's like, he almost like had to wait until, he's like, little did I know, I had to wait until Jason Schwartzman was old enough to play that character, because when he wrote it, he would have been about 19, 20 years old. It's like I needed him to age up to 35 to kind of really encapsulate who Larry is.
That's funny. That's really funny. Yeah, I actually was lucky enough to have Bob Byington on my podcast on Piecing It Together, talking about Francis Ferguson. And yeah, he's an interesting character. And his movies, they definitely do seem to go under the radar. They seem to be those kind of movies that do really well at the festivals and then just kind of disappear into obscurity. And eventually people find them and like them or don't, you know, depending on the movie. But, you know, they definitely have a weird life. Like when you were reading that, you know, that box office numbers for Seven Chinese Brothers, that did not surprise me that this didn't, you know, make any kind of a splash on release.
Yeah. And what was kind of great to hear is because he's like an Austin based director.
Yeah.
He did like a Q&A, I think it's for the Austin Film Society. And they were saying in the kind of introduction to him that like the city and the kind of like the film society are that into what he does, that like he always kind of benefits from like the grants they give out and the kind of funding, because like they obviously see something in him. And he's like, yeah, he makes these films. The budget for this must be minuscule. Like there's like really not anything like action packed. It's like, I guess, I don't know, the most expensive thing that might go into it is getting a couple of cars repaired from being keyed, and like,
sure,
or the money that is put in that massive tanker full of change. But I wonder
if they got any Buca di Beppo money, you know, product placement.
Yeah, is Quick Lube, is that an actual company?
It is. Yeah. It is. Oh, yeah, these are all real. Everything in this movie is real.
Oh, great. Yeah. I imagine Buca di Beppo were probably a bit like annoyed that the fact that they're, I don't know, it makes it look like their management are fucking schmucks. And like Buca di Beppo, not Buca di Beppo, I just like saying Buca di Beppo, Quick Lube. Really,
yeah, it's so much fun to say.
Yeah. I'm just like, Buca di Beppo. yeah, I always want to sing it. But Quick Lube are probably really happy because they make, like, this film makes like that place looking like the best place ever to work. Do you know what I mean? Like,
oh yeah, absolutely. Although you might get your change stolen if you take your car there.
Yes. And I don't know what it says that the person responsible is one of the only, like, I don't know. It's somebody obviously of like Hispanic heritage. Like,
yeah.
It's not the white guy working there, is it? Come on.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a choice.
So let's talk about like the cast in this film. What do you think of the kind of, what do you think of Jason Schwartzman's portrayal as Larry? And we cannot talk about Larry without talking about the shining star of this movie, the only Coppola I haven't talked about, his debut feature and possibly his only feature ever, Arrow Schwartzman. Yeah, what do you think of that pairing of, and for those of you who don't know, Arrow Schwartzman is Jason Schwartzman's French bulldog. Before we get into talk about their relationship as well, I just want to play a clip of Bob Byington and Jason Schwartzman talking about this lovely hound.
The dog was written as a tough, mean dog. It was actually written as a German Shepherd, and it was based on a German Shepherd that I knew. And Jason was not really involved with casting. He did say, maybe you should meet Arrow. Once I met Arrow, I knew why he wanted me to meet Arrow, because Arrow's incredible. I mean, moments after I met Arrow, I was like, that's the dog.
My character in the movie, he's a guy that really isn't doing much. His dog is really the only person that he cares about. In the script, it was like that, you know, that he loves this animal. But when Bob met my dog and wanted to put him in the movie, it kind of made sense in a different way to me, because I think it probably would have been strange to just, like, talk to some strange dog.
Never a good idea, keying someone's car.
Arrow really did seem to know what we were doing, and it was weird because he seemed to, like, know he was looking at the camera when he would do it. And it started to freak us out a little bit.
I was really proud of him. He's actually a great dog to be in a movie because he has a real, like, just tiredness that was wonderful for shooting purposes. He would just, like, walk into the room we were shooting and he would just, like, fall asleep on a couch, like, okay, he'll probably be asleep there for about 3 hours, so let's just sort of make the scene happen sort of around this area. And that's really what we did.
So, yeah, what do you make of the relationship between Jason Schwartzman and his dog? It's probably, I don't know, one of the key relationships in this film.
Yeah, well, first of all, it's an honor to be speaking on the only episode that Arrow will end up on, most likely. He is a great actor, and he does such a great job in this movie. Their relationship is so much fun. It, like, just the way that Schwartzman is just constantly talking to him very much reminds me of me and my dog Harvey. Also a very sleepy, very cute, very snorty kind of dog with it's mixed with a bunch of different stuff, but including some French bulldog type breeds in there as well. A lot of snorting involved with Harvey, but they're so much fun to watch, and the way that he's just constantly talking to him. And I loved in that interview clip you just played about how he said about how, like, sleepy he is. I describe this movie as kind of nihilistic, but there's also, like, a very like depression kind of bent to it, to the character and to the kind of sleepiness of it, and not really wanting to improve your lot in life in any way. And I feel the dog captures that as well. Much. And he's just such a great sidekick character. He's just awesome to watch.
Well, I think one of the key scenes involving the dog that very much kind of sums up the whole movie somewhat is that moment when Don and the manager from Bupa de Beco kind of come round to pay vengeance upon Larry and kind of have this plan to feed the dog frozen hot dogs and kind of just, like, mess up his apartment a bit. They write fat on a picture of Arrow. They like piss on his floor. I think they put something in his mouthwash, like maybe like replace it with booze or something like that. And he's kind of like something that doesn't faze Larry, because, like, he's basically like a functioning alcoholic in this film. But, like,
yeah, pretty much. I like that he just basically couldn't tell if the guys that broke in did anything because his house was already a mess. Wasn't sure.
But the way that the dog just goes along with it is kind of like that scene in itself. There could kind of be, like, if you cut out that kind of first scene of Larry, like, getting fired from his job and, like, keying the car, and then just tack on those two scenes together, it would make a great little short. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, and then maybe ending with Larry getting punched in the face when he admits that he did key the car, and kind of,
yeah.
But yeah, like, there is a nihilism to Larry. There's kind of, but yeah, the dog and that scene in particular really encapsulates kind of the I guess this is what's happening today. I guess
exactly.
And, like, yeah, it's beautiful and, like, heartbreaking at the same time. And like, I've definitely said it on this podcast before, I'm somebody who suffers with depression. I definitely can relate to that aspect of Larry, of kind of, like, I don't know, just possibly being, like, frustrated underneath, but, like, my kind of exterior is just like, I guess this is what's, do you know what I mean? This is my lot in life, and I just have to get on with it. Like,
Yeah. Well, to add to that, not to jump around too much, but also great is the relationship with his grandma.
Yes.
And there's that line where they're out walking and they see the cat with its tail up, and she says, "The cat's got its tail up." You know what that means? It means it wants to fuck or it wants to fight. Which do you want to do? And Larry's just like, "I don't want to do neither, really." Yeah, like. Yeah. You know, he just wants to kind of go through life and just like whatever.
Yeah, you know? Which again is kind of mirrored later on in the film where he has an opportunity to fuck, like him and Major Norwood kind of go out and like have this ruse, which I guess like looking at it now could like very problematic kind of ruse to pull as well. Kind of like, I don't know,
no.
Tricking women yeah. into believing you're like a doctor and. A southern gentleman? Is that what yeah. like Larry's kind of shtick is?
I guess so.
But even when he's like kind of a woman basically throws herself at him and he's kind of like just kind of like, no, I gotta go. And it's like, I don't know, you've got this there's layers to Larry, because like it's kind of, I don't know, you're blindsided at the beginning because you're like, uh-oh, might not like this guy. And then when you kind of get to a scene like that, you're like, there's a tenderness. And I think the film plays it really well. Like the first time he sees Lupe working behind the desk at the Quick Lube, it's like, I don't know, he's got this like infatuation with her, and it never borders on like creepy. It's all kind of like quite sweet and stuff like that. And he acts like a bit of a baby, like lies about his friend and, yeah, says he's got a fake leg just to like,
yeah.
And he admits to her like, yes, because I just don't want you to fancy him. And like, so, I don't know. he's a heartbreaking character.
Yeah, and that's part of what I like about the movie so much too is, you know, again, jumping around, but, you know, by the end of the movie, you know, I feel like he, in the smallest, like lowest stakes possible way, finally cares about a little bit in his life with his job and his boss, which he doesn't love, but he at least likes enough to keep showing up. And it's like, it's not like the big string swell Hollywood, you know, happy ending, but it's this person showing a little tiny bit of growth, a little bit of acceptance, and a little bit of, you know, that there's hope for something more out of his life in the future. And I love that. I love a movie with a character that's kind of low stakes like that, where not much has changed, but a little bit has changed in the right direction.
Well, it's believable, right? It's like kind of nothing, yeah. Nothing really happens in those grand ways. It's like steady progress, and it's a slice of life. I'm trying to think like the period in which this film takes across. Doesn't feel like that long, maybe like a matter of weeks, like a month
yeah.
2 months maybe. Like it's kind of very much is like, I don't know. Yeah. And you could imagine this. It's almost like has the trappings of being like a kind of teen summer movie, like getting that. Do you know what I mean? You like, you could see it in that mold of being like, you get the job somewhere that you really like and stuff like that. But it's like, it's got this twinge of sadness to it because, no, this is a man yeah. in his 30s. Do you know what I mean? He's finding that job he loves. Do you know what I mean? It's not that kind
yeah.
of one summer to change your life. It's like that kind of just, I don't know, 1 month that you kind of go, hey, maybe things are not as bad as they were. And maybe, yeah, maybe I can just curb my drinking a bit more. Maybe I can learn Spanish. Yeah. Like,
yeah, yeah. Yeah, those are all good things. It's positive in its own very small way.
Yes, yeah. So, yeah, you mentioned the grandma played amazingly by Olympia Dukakis. What are your thoughts on their scenes that they shared together?
Oh, she's great. She's really fun. And like, I feel like a lot of us have, you know, that kind of a relative who is, you know, really sweet, but also you don't have that great of a relationship with, but enough of a good relationship that it's, you know, it's a nice thing. And he's all she has and she's all he has. But then, you know, as we find out, she ends up leaving her money to the guy who is working at the place, which is also his best friend, kind of. It's all very messy, but their relationship is really great. I love all of Larry's relationships in this. His relationship with his dog, his relationship with his best friend, his relationship with his grandma, with his boss. They're all like really interesting, well-drawn relationships.
Yeah. And I even like the kind of, that we get a nice like payoff to all of those kind of relationships, right, throughout the film. Even the kind of the bosses from Bupe de Beco, like we get the kind of like nice little payoff when he just like, I don't know, you see that growth in that when he just goes back to get his check. Like you kind of imagine the Larry you meet at the beginning of this film would have just never thought to do that. Do you know what I mean? He'd never, right. Like even though he's owed money, would have just like, oh yeah, this is what I do now. Like, I shouldn't go back there. But it's like, I don't know. Then there's a big cathartic moment in the film as well, where he like just guts his apartment, right, of kind of all of his like earthly possessions for, I don't know. I'm trying to figure out his rationale for that. What do you think of that scene? And what do you think like Larry was trying to achieve?
I almost felt like that was him trying to have a bigger Hollywood ending to his character arc, like something more profound, more big. And then it just kind of doesn't work out. And instead we get the smaller thing that the movie actually ends up ending on. And I don't know. To me, it's almost like a throwing out that kind of a character arc in that scene.
Yeah. You could imagine, I don't know, a film ending on that, and then from that moment on, they're kind of dressed differently. They're cocksure. Mm-hmm. They're kind of really like sure about who they are as a person. Whereas, like, and it kind of plays into the fact that Larry doesn't really think about what the next step is too much. Like, he kind of just he's always just the actions he makes throughout the film. Like, it's kind of like I'm just. Just, I don't know, drifting and floating through life. Like, there's the moment where he goes to meet the attorney played by Stephen Root.
And
instead of like taking his kind of crapped out car back with him, he just decides to hitchhike instead. Right? Yeah. Is that right? That is what he does.
Right. Yeah.
And that makes for a really interesting scene. And I guess like, plays into that audience idea as well, of the kind of insufferable lead, but like the film charms you enough. And I think it's Schwartzman's charm that kind of wins you over. And in that scene, mm-hmm. we see it, right? Like him and that the guy he has a confrontation with, who's played by Alex Ross Perry, the director mm-hmm. of Listen Up, Philip. They begin with this argument, and like Philip gets punched in the face, and then the next thing we know, they're kind of talking about like animals, and he's in the back of the car getting a lift at the getting a ride at the end of the day.
So you like animals? Yeah, I like animals, not birds, but most animals. I love him in this. He's so good, Alex Ross Perry.
Yeah. Really, like I loved that scene. I think it is the kind of it. I don't know, like I said, it proves to the audience like we're probably having that same reaction that guy has throughout watching the film, right?
Yeah.
It's like, I would like to punch this guy in the face, and then like you spend enough time with him, it's kind of like, oh, he's quite lovable actually. I want to make sure he's okay.
Yeah. Well, you know, one thing I hadn't really even thought of until right now, but I'm realizing all of the male characters are kind of idiots when it comes down to it. Like, but both of the main female characters, being his boss at the Quick Lube and then his grandma, are pretty, you know, well-to-do, you know, grounded people. Whereas almost every man that Larry deals with is an idiot or a man child or just ridiculous in some way, including Alex Ross Perry in this car. He's just so ridiculous. That whole scene is ridiculous. So I feel like that's also something that's going on here, is just like kind of maybe the arrested development of, you know, men in that particular age group.
Yeah. Like when he goes out with Norwood to like a bar, he's like, he's just as bad as Larry.
He really is.
He's clearly, if not worse, like, because he's stealing Yeah, he's stealing drugs from the care facility he works at to get high with.
Yeah, just trying random ones, seeing what'll happen.
Larry's there like, hey, how come you took a handful? You only gave me one. Like, and then it's kind of, you can tell that it's a regular ruse that he pulls by pretending to be a doctor, because he kind of wears these like scrubs and has a stethoscope. And yeah, it's like Larry just kind of goes along with it. We kind of see that, I don't know. Yeah, Larry just feels like a bit of a rube, like sometimes. You know what I mean, like, mm-hmm. when they discuss that night a bit later on in the film, and like Norwood's kind of going, oh, do you not know about like it's called the Battle of the Sexes? And it just feels like you could tell Larry anything. He'd go, oh, is it? Like, is that why it's called the Battle of the Sexes? Because you're trying to sure. try to battle them into bed?
Yeah. Yeah. He has no agency of his own. He's just kind of just floating around.
Yeah. That is a really interesting point about like, and rightfully as well. We like, I'll say this as a man, we are all fucking idiots.
You know what I mean? Oh yeah, absolutely.
So yeah, what other scenes and kind of like points did you want to touch upon in this film, Bill David?
Oh man, I'm trying to think of any specifics. I mean, I just love a lot of his just little non sequiturs and one liners, you know, his little impressions and stuff like that. All that is really funny. His terrible Vampire Weekend karaoke was great. that was really good. The funeral scene, going back to what we were just talking about just how awful the male characters are. I mean, everyone in that scene is just awful. The guy who wants to kill himself, basically, and he's trying to figure out the best way to do it. And then one of my biggest laughs of the movie is where it's like a total throwaway line, but when Jason Schwartzman asks his friend, do I look like that religious man? Which the whole time you're thinking it, like the priest looks just like Jason Schwartzman, but not too much like him, like just enough like him to put it in your mind. And then he flat out says it, and I just laughed so hard at that.
Yeah, that's really good. I've actually pulled a clip from Larry's speech that he gives
nice.
Just because I think it's, I don't know, it is kind of, this is a moment of growth for the character.
Hi, I was her grandson. Or I guess I'm her grandson still. And she's my only surviving relative. And I know she felt alone a lot. And now I feel alone a little too. And she helped me a lot. And I plan to, I like where I work, or I don't know, worked. And I'd like to do my work well. Usually I don't like my work. I tend not to, but I like my boss. She's very helpful, and she makes everyone feel just right. So that makes it a place that I look forward to going to, which I've never had before, really. God, this is unusual. I've never stood in a room with a group and said what I was going to do with my life. Except in grade school when we all want to be astronauts. No one remembers that. I'm going to work on the Spanish that she suggested I work on, and I don't know, try to be a good or better person. It's the plan.
What I love about that speech is kind of like just things he says wrong and the kind of like missteps, and you kind of tell like the insecurities in him. Like, when obviously it's a somber moment, and he mentions about like, when we wanted to be astronauts and nobody reacts, he's like, oh, just me then, like,
yeah,
or I'm gonna be better, gooder, like I think he says, like, which obviously,
yeah, like, something like that
doesn't, yeah, like, yeah, gooder, better, and it's like doesn't quite make sense, but it's kind of got this naivety to it, and like the fact that his speech is about like kind of, yeah, just I'm happy with like this small thing I've got in my life, which is just like cleaning cars. Do you know what I mean? Like, he's just hoovering, vacuuming cars. And it's like, he kind of, I don't know, like, again, like, back to the All Men Are Idiots. Like, we get that brilliant moment before that by Stephen Root, where like, he's like, I was her attorney. I knew that there was going to be this like speech at the funeral, because they have that like tape, don't they, right, of of the grandma saying like, oh, I want you to kind of do better with, or like, like, yeah, I want you to all do better with your lives. If you want to do something, do it, kind of thing. And like Stephen Roots, like, kind of was like, I've not been a good dad. I'm going to be better. And he's like, oh, I knew that was coming. And I'm like, that's all I had. And I think he then says something to Larry, right, about like, he's like, oh, you really killed me. And I knew that, I knew that was coming. He's like, yeah, like, I didn't prepare a speech. He kind of killed it off the cuff.
Stephen Root's so great. It just feels like he just showed up for this, you know, moment and is just out the door, you know?
Yeah, he's fantastic. He's one of those actors that, like, kind of just turns up when you least expect it and stuff. You
know? Yeah.
I remember recently watching Succession, and there's, like, just one episode in season 3. It's like, oh, Stephen Root's in it. It's like, of course Stephen Root's in it. It's like, he's one of those kind of understated character actors who, like, I don't know, you kind of don't realize you love until you see him in something again and go, oh, I fucking love this guy.
Yeah, yeah. I wonder if anyone has a Stephen Root podcast. That would be a good podcast.
Oh, rooting around.
Yeah, like, there you go.
You've got a name there. You got rooting around, the Stephen Root podcast.
I'll be a guest on it if anybody wants to. Yeah.
Yeah, like, I kind of, whilst doing, like, research of this, kind of just, like, had to scroll through his IMDb. A lot of credits, a lot of, like, TV work and stuff like that. I think he's done a lot of, a lot of voices on, like, King of the Hill, obviously, Mike Judge with Office Space as well.
Sure. Right?
So obviously must be a connection there. But, yeah, he's an absolute, like, joy in this film. I'm just going to call him Tunde just because I'm very bad. You may have heard or you may not have heard because I would have edited it out in the intro. I got his name wrong. But yeah, like, for those of you who don't know, he's like one of the founding members of the fantastic Brooklyn-based band TV on the Radio, who I'm not sure if you're a fan, David, but I absolutely love TV on the Radio. So just to see this beautiful man in this film was kind of like, even more of a selling point, being like, yes, like, I'm excited to watch this film because it's somebody, like, I like this other avenue of creativity they do, so I'm sure they're going to be great in this.
He's only been in a few movies, but he's really good.
Yeah. He plays that kind of, I don't know, they all play dumb really well. And I think, I think that's quite hard to do. Without it kind of being, I don't know, getting into, again, not to, I haven't watched it in a few years, so I can't really comment on the, like, quality of it, but, like, getting into that, like, Jared Hess universe, like Napoleon Dynamite, do you know what I mean? Like, this kind of, I don't know, unapproachable, do you know what I mean? Like, this, I imagine, I don't know, like, a mainstream audience could get into this a bit more. Like, Napoleon Dynamite kind of has that feeling like, you don't get it, you ain't into it. Do you know what I mean?
Exactly. Like, yeah.
I'd imagine more people, if they had the chance to see this film, might kind of find something in it that they like.
Yeah. And by the way, the score sounds a lot like the Napoleon Dynamite score as well. So,
well, yeah, as a musician and a composer, David, what do you make of the Chris Baio score for this? Obviously, guitarist in Vampire Weekend, isn't he?
Right. Yeah. Very strange, but very fitting. I mean, it's a perfect score for these kinds of characters, the kind of smallness of the story. It just fits really well. It does a great job.
Yeah. What, like, this can sound like an insult. And I kind of, like, with the music and, like, the film itself, like, and this isn't an insult at all. It kind of, like, gives me hope, and it, like, kind of feels like there's, like, if I made a film, or, like, if I wrote music for a film, like, this is probably what I would do. Like, it kind of all feels quite achievable. Do you know what I mean? Like, I don't know. Like, yeah, I could imagine just, like, I don't know, like, the budget doesn't seem big, but, like, this is the kind of story I probably would tell about this, like, loosely veiled for myself misanthropic guy who kind of, I don't know, bumbles his way through life and tries to figure stuff out. In my version, he probably would be a podcaster.
Yeah, sure, absolutely. Yeah, I feel like that's kind of the vibe of a lot of Austin filmmakers. That's kind of like never reaching too far, like sticking in that very homemade indie kind of aesthetic.
And obviously, like, I don't know, there is obviously a lineage, like, that probably dates back somewhat to Wes Anderson, right? He started making films in the 90s, another Austin-based, well, he started off, he, like, grew up in Texas, at least. And I think Rushmore was shot there. Would it, like, I find it interesting around this period in Jason Schwartzman's career, this and, like, Listen Up, Philip, two films he kind of made back to back. Both characters almost feel like two sides of a coin of who Max Fisher could have become as he grew up, right? Like, Listen Up, Philip, I'm not sure if you've seen that movie, but, like, a bit more higher achieving and more arrogant with it, like, is like an author and stuff like that. Whereas this, it's kind of like, I don't know, he might have flunked out of the community college he was at. Do you know what I mean? Like,
sure.
Yeah, it's like, listen up, Philip. Yeah. He got back into Rushmore and, like, graduated and wrote a book. And this one is like, stayed at community college and kind of drifted through life.
I need to watch Listen Up, Philip. It sounds like it would be right up my alley. And I thought I saw it back when it came out, but I'm not really recalling it. So I'm putting that at the top of my watch list.
Yes. Yeah, yeah. I think it's really interesting. Like, my kind of eyes have been opened recently to this, yeah, like, new school of directors. And I'm really, like, interested in Bob Byington and Alex Ross Perry now. They kind of make these, like, really interesting films and about these kind of characters who are hard to love, but, like, for me, quite easy to like. Like, approachable. Yeah, that for me, they're like, I see a lot of myself in them, even though, like, Listen Up, Philip, he's a real insufferable prick. I'm like, I've probably been that insufferable prick at times.
We all have a little bit of it in us, so, you know.
One of the things I wanted to talk about is kind of the payoff we get for one of the things that Larry gets when he first starts his job is this kind of threat from one of his co-workers, Johnny, that he has to deliver $20 a day for him and, like, put it in, like, this kind of tanker tub in the middle of the quick loop. And the way that kind of, like, that pays off, right? It's like the same day as the funeral. And, like, I guess after that, talk about this crushing scene where kind of everything that can go wrong in Larry's life goes wrong. But kind of, yeah, what do you think to that kind of payoff scene where we get the kind of Larry kind of, I don't know, growing slightly and kind of not letting people walk over him when he kind of kicks over that big tank full of money?
Yeah, it all kind of just comes together at the same time. All of the little bits and pieces of plot, really, that finally kind of come together and we get it all on the same day. But yeah, I mean, I guess you need that. Otherwise, the people who... Yeah, like we've said, this is definitely not a movie that everybody is going to connect with because of the character and because of the kind of point of view of the movie. But if you don't at least build towards something, you got to get something in there for it all to kind of come to a head at. And so that is the moment where all these things kind of come together.
Yeah, and I guess another scene that's similar to that is, like, when Larry kind of finds out that Lupe is dating Norwood. And then
sure.
He's going to lose his job because he finds out that the guy who owns the Quick Lube also owned the Bupa de Beco as well. Mm-hmm. It's like, and like, just to cap it off, he gets, like, a phone call to go to the care facility and his grandma. And it's kind of like, what a fucking, like, real,
like,
yeah, what a day.
By the way, Alex Karpovsky in that, like, basically one or two scene role. But yeah, he's also great in everything. I think he was in another one of Bob Byington's movies as well.
Yeah, I love him. I always loved him. I think from the first time I saw him on the TV show Girls, I was like, he was somebody I was like, in this kind of sea of vapid people, I love this guy because he's like, he's kind of speaking truth to power. Against all these kind of, I don't know, against Lena Dunham's character and all that shit. So let's potentially talk about like the end of this film and like kind of some of the, I don't know, like the moments where things come together, whether it is, yeah, like Larry making amends for like in Larry's perfect way, making amends for his, for keying. What is he like, the maitre d's? Oh, I don't know, like, so, like John,
something like that.
Yeah. I don't know, this film takes funny turns. I really like those moments when like he realizes that they're kind of like they're following him, like kind of like it's like it really throws you like, where is this movie going?
Yeah, and ultimately doesn't go many places at all, because again, like we've been talking about, like that, it's all just so small. It's like go as small as you can and then go even smaller in the worldview and in the idea of like how far any of this character's story is going to go. So yeah, like we were saying, it just doesn't really, it doesn't amount to a lot by the end, but you have seeing a character grow that slight little bit by the end. And so there is a hopefulness to that. And I love that. And then like right up to the very last scene, it's just back to Larry and his dog, you know, and that's really, no matter what he learns outside of it, that's the central part of his life. That's the best part.
Yeah. I like that this film, because obviously like a mainstream film, the change would be kind of like, I don't know, the changing of seasons, like kind of almost, sure. Whereas this is like the change of a day. Do you know what I mean? This is kind of like, yeah, like a little bit of me. I'm not a complete different person, but like maybe I'm on the way to being a little bit better. And I know that Jason Schwartzman said in a Q&A for this film that he found playing the character of Larry like quite hard, in that most of the films he's done, like his characters have like that one thing they're after, like to take kind of a touch point of that, like Rushmore, like he wants his Rushmore, whether that is Mrs. Cross. It, do you know what I mean? Like that, the Max Fisher has that one thing he wants. He wants to be at that school, or he wants that teacher. Whereas this, like Larry is far more aimless and kind of doesn't know what he wants. So yeah, Jason Schwartzman said that, it's like to find like the kind of motivation in the character was a bit more difficult than it is for a lot of like roles he's played, because he kind of doesn't have that. Here's your clear goal. Yeah.
Because they're floating around just aimlessly and without a clear goal, that must be much more difficult to play.
Yeah. And one of the things, this little fun little tidbit I heard as well, is he was too scared to ask Bob Byington the title of this film means, like in relation to the film. What does it mean to you? Does it mean anything to you? Do you care if it means anything?
I mean, I eventually ended up Googling it and found out that it was an REM song, but that's the closest thing I have. And even looking at the lyrics to that REM song, it doesn't really match up. So I'm really not sure.
Yeah. It's, again, like when Jason Schwartzman was talking about it, he kind of said like, he kind of likes that. He likes it in music. It's like some songs like will be something that's in the chorus, or do you know what I mean? Like it would be called like That Lonely Weekend. Then the song will be about a lonely weekend, or a film might have the same title and it's like about the same thing. Do you know what I mean? World Trade Center is a film about 9/11. Do you know what I mean? It does what it says on the tin. Whereas like, it's like, this is I think that title suits the film, because the film kind of I don't know, in the best way possible, doesn't really going where it wants, doesn't really know what it's kind of doing in the best kind of way. And it's like, you can't quantify that. Do you know what I mean? If this was like a Dax Shepard vehicle written like a few years earlier, might have been called like Lucked Out Larry or something, or Larry's Lucked Out. Do you know what I mean? Like, it's a slacker comedy of the summer. Like,
exactly.
This isn't that. Like, this is kind of like slackers for real slackers, almost like has the aesthetic made by like a kind of professional slacker. Again, in the bet, like, not to disparage Bob Byington in any way. It's kind of like,
My best theory would be, and I don't know how autobiographical this movie is to Bob Byington's, like, some point in his life, but my guess would be that the REM song, Seven Chinese Brothers, was like his favorite song at a moment when he was just kind of floating through life and just kind of aimlessly walking around and not doing much. And that's where the name comes from. That's the best guess I could come up with.
That's probably right. That's probably like the soundtrack inside Larry's head, right? It's kind of, he's bumming about, listening to REM, listening to the Cars, singing some Vampire Weekend.
We've all been there.
Yeah, exactly.
It would be a Cure song for me, but REM's awesome too. Yeah. So
before we start to wrap things up and get out of here, David, what is there anything we've missed in this film? Is there anything that you wanted to touch upon, or anything you don't like about this film as well?
Honestly, it's funny because this movie, like, it doesn't have the best reviews. Like, if you go on Letterboxd and stuff like that, a lot of people did not connect with it that much. But I can't think of anything I didn't like about this movie. I really, really liked it a lot. I know it's certainly not for everybody. But as far as anything we didn't touch on, I mean, not really. I just jotted down, like, if this had been a movie, if I had had piecing it together back when, this movie came out, some puzzle pieces I might have thought of would have been Richard Linklater's Slacker, Kevin Smith's Clerks, and we already talked about Mike Judge earlier, but Office Space as well. Those are the three things that kind of came to mind as kind of getting into the same kind of headspace as what this movie kind of does.
They're all, that's why you are the king. Piecing it together, David. That's why you are who you are. You say, I never really look at Rotten Tomatoes on this podcast, but I thought I'd just quickly pull it up when you were talking about reviews here. It's really interesting. Based on 36 reviews from critics, this has got a 78% on Rotten Tomatoes.
Oh, that's better than I would have expected. Wow.
But I think, like, when you talk about the kind of letterbox reviews and the kind of, let's be honest, like, What a lot of people are more drifting towards now in this kind of, like, I don't know, age of, like, the critic being dead almost. Like,
right.
500 plus reviews, this has 44% audience score. So you can kind of, you can kind of see this film not connecting with audiences. But yeah, like you said, like, I don't know, I think there's us misanthropes out there who kind of find something to hold on to in this film, and thank you for bringing it to my attention probably sooner than it possibly would have been covered on this podcast. And I think it's great that kind of on a 1-2 bounce in the kind of Jason Schwartzman films covered on this podcast, we've kind of had, well, basically I guess it would have been the films he made consecutively after each other, so Listen Up Philip and Seven Chinese Brothers, which, as I said at the beginning, are very much bedfellow films. So I kind of think of I'll be definitely recommending that to people as a nice little misanthropic double bill.
Nice.
So as we start to head out the door, David, I always like to ask my guests, did you manage to find any Coppola connections in this film? Any other people in this film who have worked with any other Coppolas elsewhere in their filmography?
Well, I think this would qualify, but Jason Schwartzman's band Phantom Planet, their Big Brat music video is directed by Spike Jones. And Spike Jones, this kind of gets away from the Coppola family, but directed an REM music video.
Oh, so I like that. Yeah, that's a nice connection to the
kind of ties it in.
Yeah, there we go. I'll run off a couple I've got here. So I've got Olympia Dukakis was in a few episodes of Bored to Death, the TV series with...
I love Bored to Death. Such a good show.
To be covered at some point on this very podcast. I just need to figure out how I'm going to cover it. And she's also in Moonstruck with Nicolas Cage. And then, Alex Karpovsky is in Crypto Zoo with Jason Schwartzman, a film that I believe came out last year. It's an animated movie by Dashno, I want to say. I might have been wrong on that name, but yeah, they're in that together. And as mentioned in the episode, Alex Ross Perry directed Jason Schwartzman in Listen Up, Philip, and Golden Exit. So yeah, Alex Ross Perry in an acting role here. Somebody who I am trying very much to get on the podcast. And I'll say this on the podcast, if you're listening, Alex, I've kind of, it's been a funny, interesting road. Alex is kind of unsure whether like this is a, I don't know, like a TMZ style spill the beans on the Coppola family podcast. And if you're listening, Alex, I've said to you in correspondence, this is not that. I just love to talk about their work, and I would love to talk to you about the films you made with Jason Schwartzman, including Seven Chinese Brothers.
Awesome. Yeah.
So David, let's rate this film. And the way we do that here on this podcast, I like to ask my guests, what would be the perfect wine pairing for this film?
So I'm not much of a wine expert. So instead, I'm going to go with a giant big gulp, like Jason Schwartzman is drinking from through most of the movie, filled with a little bit of whiskey, I believe he pours in there, along with his, I'm assuming, Coke. So let's go with a big one of those. Does that work?
Yeah. It's kind of, it's like that is the slacker's choice drink, right? Kind of like a,
yeah.
I think it's the bottle of tequila he nicks from the bar, right? That's
Okay, I'll go straight on the tequila then. We don't need a mixer in there.
Yeah, because Olympia Dukakis kind of has a sip. She's like, "Oh, tequila!" I find that interesting as well. Like, you kind of, in that moment, you get a sense that she's had a bit of a past as well. Do you know what I mean? Maybe like her problems with drinking as well, and it's kind of, I don't know. It's never explained where his parents have gone. Why he doesn't seem to have any connection to his parents whatsoever. Obviously, well, they must be dead, right? Because it says he's the only living heir to her estate, and that's given to his best friend.
There's layers, but we'll never know.
So would that be a bottom shelf, middle shelf, or top shelf big gulp? Is this a normal big gulp, a mega big gulp, or the biggest big gulp you can get? AKA, is this film any good, David?
Yes. It's going top shelf, especially if we're going with it being tequila that we're pouring in there. I'm not going to drink any lower level tequila, but either way, it would be top shelf. I love this movie.
Perfect. Well, yeah, as I said, thank you so much for bringing it to my attention. I always love to find these kind of gems, and of an actor who's kind of quite well known as well. And it seems like he's got this bane of his career of doing this like interesting stuff, and I love when people help me shine a light on that. And I'm always excited to look through podcast platforms as well and realize, hey, I think this is going to be the only podcast out there that has covered Seven Chinese Brothers,
probably.
So I think I may know your answer to this question, since how much you're a fan of this movie, but based on Seven Chinese Brothers, are the Coppolas the greatest film family of all time?
Of course. I mean, come on. There's so many amazing people in this family tree. You sent me that little family tree graphic before we started, and it's ridiculous.
Yes. Yeah. It's even when you start to delve into like some of the lesser known people, or people you may not realize are kind of part of the family, like a Stephanie Schwartzman, who is Jason and Robert's like stepsister, like kind of has this career in the 90s working in like the costume and set departments for like a couple of Tim Burton films, so like Edward Scissorhands and Ed Wood, and kind of did The Little Princess, The Birdcage, Memoirs of the Invisible Man, this really interesting, and then Jonathan Schwartzman as well has got a kind of really interesting career as this, like, I don't know, journeyman. I know that can sound like an insult, but like this kind of like, DOP for hire, kind of helping Michael Bay out in those early years before he went full Bayhem and kind of lost people for a while. But from what I hear of Ambulance, he's got people back on side, baby.
Oh, yeah. ambulance rules.
And, they are kind of an ever-expanding, always fascinating family.
Oh, yeah.
So let's get out of here, David. But I always like to ask two questions before we go. And the first one is, which Coppola family member would you keep, but in doing so, you get rid of the entire filmography of the rest of the family?
This is such a tough question. I think Jason Schwartzman would be my runner up, but you got to go Nicolas Cage.
Ooh.
I mean, how can you get rid of Nicolas Cage's cinematic output? I mean, my favorite movie of all time is Adaptation. So, like, you know, how could you get rid of Nicolas Cage?
Yeah. It's a toughie, right? It's kind of, I was talking to someone about this last night about, like, I love it when people just come from the heart as well. Like, people have come on this podcast before and gone, I'll go with, like, Francis Ford Coppola because all the stuff he's done for cinema. And it's like, nah, I don't want any of that. I want what's in your heart. Like, I want what's in your heart.
Exactly. You got to go with your heart.
Yeah. Well, like, obviously, to peek behind the curtain, we will possibly be having a conversation about Nicolas Cage very soon on your podcast. Sizzle. No. Piece the puzzle together yourself, listeners. As to guess when this was recorded, what is it that you love so much about Nicolas Cage as an actor?
I mean, one of the best ranges, I would say, of any living actor right now. I mean, to be able to do things that are genuinely some of the best performances you've ever seen, to some of the craziest performances you've ever seen, to funny, to heartbreaking, just everything in between. He's just incredible when it comes to that. And he, you know, even if he makes some weird choices along the way, he makes some of the best movies as well. So, I mean, it's really just an exciting person to, like, follow over the years. And I think we also kind of grew up at the perfect time to, like, just be along for the ride of this particular actor in cinema history.
Yeah, I think it was, like, Ethan Hawke, like, said that Nicolas Cage is, like, one of the last people to really do something different with art form and kind of change it in a way.
Yeah.
And it's kind of, I think that's true, right? It kind of encapsulates, like, elements of, like, kabuki theater, German expressionism, kind of is. And, like, I'm gonna quote myself. I got quoted in a BBC article recently, and it's something I stand by. Is
nice.
Nicolas Cage is not afraid to, like, act, like, all caps act. Do you know what I mean? Whether that, if that needs, like, a kind of crazy face, or if that needs, like, a, I don't know, his body, like, throwing around, he's going to do it. And it's that's what you want from someone, right? You kind of want somebody who's going to, I don't know, and that's what I love about him, is every movie, like you said, like, could be crazy, could be funny, could be sad, could be one of the best films you've ever seen. Every movie's a roll of the dice. And, like,
yes,
I think that's why he's been, like, the eternal underdog of cinema, and kind of why people like me and you possibly, like, just root for him all the time. Cause it's like, he could always, I don't know, like his uncle in the way that Francis Ford Coppola would bet all his money at the table on a film.
Yeah.
Nicolas Cage seems to be doing the same thing with his acting.
By the way, every movie is a roll of the dice. That's another good quote for you to use in the future. I like that.
thank you very much. So, let's close off by asking possibly the most important question here on this podcast, David, which is, what does Bill Murray say to Scarlett Johansson at the end of Lost in Translation?
I'm going to go with a line from Seven Chinese Brothers that Larry says to his dog. Do you like cats?
Because I'm going to be in Garfield, baby.
Yeah.
He also makes allusions to Garfield, doesn't he? He's like, yeah, you're like that animated cat, but a real life dog.
Yeah. That's a great line.
Well, that feels like a perfect place to end it, David. So thank you so much for coming and making some Coppola connections with me.
Thank you so much for having me. This was fun.
And there we have it, guys. A fantastic episode, if I do say so myself. Another massive thank you to David Rosen for coming on this episode and enlightening me to this film. I thought it was an absolute joy, and I will certainly be diving into some more Bob Byington work. It's a kind of the slacker comedy that I very much enjoy. And how much, British listeners, how much do you want there to be a Booper De Becco in England? Just so you can say Booper De Becco all the time. I love saying Booper De Becco. If you agree with me, don't hesitate to get in touch. You can do so by hitting me up on all the socials. So that is Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, Letterboxd, and TikTok at CagedInPod. Or you can always drop me an email, which is cagedinpod@gmail.com. A massive thank you to all of you guys as well who've been massively supportive. You know who you are. In regards to all the stuff that's been happening lately, whether it's the kind of massive talent stuff, like doing the junket and stuff like that, loads of people have been reaching out, been really supportive, being like, this is like, do you know what I mean? We've seen all the hard work, this is amazing stuff, like congratulating me and stuff. That really does mean the world to me. And a massive shout out as well to a previous guest on the podcast, Anna Bogutskaya, who you saw my quote. She interviewed me for a BBC Culture article all about Nicolas Cage, which, I'll put in the show notes because I'm super proud of it. Those of you who follow me on socials might have seen me sharing it, but it's really like, I don't know. It was a surreal feeling. I came out of the cinema that day having watched The Northman and just saw that article had gone live and I'd been tagged in a tweet, and I was just like, whoa, here we go. Like, my words are actually in there, and like, it's really crazy. Like, a quote I had was like pulled out and put big as kind of like, yeah, it's a crazy feeling. And all of the stuff lately as well. And obviously, I don't know, not to sound arrogant, but yeah, I'm super proud of the stuff I've managed to achieve with this podcast, considering like I started this when I was pretty depressed living in Brighton, and now I'm kind of getting to speak to all these amazing people, having these fantastic conversations with all of the fantastic guests I have on. And it blows my mind all the time. And I don't think I'd be anywhere if it wasn't for people listening. So a massive thank you to all of you guys. It really does mean the absolute world to me. I cherish and love you all deeply. As for next week on the podcast, we will be delving into some real unbearable weight of massive talent pool. Yeah, we're gonna be diving right in, and it's gonna be a mega episode. I haven't recorded this yet, and I'm racked with anxiety as to how it will turn out. But I will be joined by Daryl Edge of the Cage Rage podcast, all the guys from the Cage Fighting podcast, and both the guys from this podcast was written on the back of the Declaration of Independence, to kind of talk all about the unbearable weight of massive talent in what we're dubbing the Unbearable Weight of Nicolas Cage podcast. But it's not all we're going to be talking about. This is kind of going to be the first part of the chat will be about massive talent, and then the second part will be all about our top five Nicolas Cage films, and we're going to kind of score them like using a point system, like 5 = 1 point, and trying to determine a ultimate top five Nicolas Cage film. So it's going to be hopefully a nice, fun, heated debate that we'll hash it out. And as always, like, let me know what are your top five Nick Cage films. I'm gonna do the same thing with all the fan answers and stuff like that, and kind of divvy them up against ours, and maybe even just throw them in as well, so we'll get the ultimate kind of caged in top five Nicolas Cage films, which is always subject to change. Mine changes constantly. There's a lot of recency bias, there's a lot of stuff to factor in. There's kind of like the moment you think of a five, you go, oh, what about that film, and then what about that film, and then it's kind of ever going in your head of just like, fuck, I don't want to miss that baby. I don't want to miss that baby. It's like picking your children for me. It's so, so very hard to narrow it down to five Nicolas Cage films. I haven't even begun to think of mine, and I'm going to be recording this podcast in 2 days' time, the time you're listening to this. It's maybe like 5 days' time at the time I'm recording, but it's all going to be okay. I'm confident I can whittle down my favourite Nick Cage films to five. And at the end of the day, it doesn't really matter anyway. It's all just a bit of fun, isn't it? Well, if you enjoyed this episode or any other episode of the podcast, please do be sure to rate and review this podcast on Acast, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you're listening to this right now. Don't forget to, in your review, to tell me what you think Scarlett Johansson is told by Bill Murray at the end of Lost in Translation. Should I say that again? What does Bill Murray say to Scarlett Johansson at the end of Lost in Translation? Leave that in your review. That will be much, much, much appreciated. So as always, guys, I've been Petrus Patsilivus, your guide through the crazy world of the Coppola family tree. Remember to keep it caged in, and I'll catch you next time.
If there's one thing that my family and friends know me for, it's being an amazing gift giver. I owe it all to Celebrations Passport from 1-800-Flowers.com, my one-stop shopping site that has amazing gifts for every occasion. With Celebrations Passport, I get free shipping on thousands of amazing gifts. And the more gifts I give, the more perks and rewards I earn. To learn more and take your gift giving to the next level, visit 1-800-Flowers.com/ACAST. That's 1-800-Flowers.com/ACAST.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.
This podcast is presented by the Breadcrumbs Collective, home of the Pod Charles Cinecast, Caged In Coppola Connections, A Driptown Limerie Maine, Franchised, and many more to come. Our shows are all presented ad-free and made possible by listeners like you. Please support our shows by subscribing, leaving ratings and reviews, and becoming patrons at patreon.com. If you'd like to learn more about Breadcrumbs, head over to breadcrumbscollective.com.
Breadcrumbs. It's more than a podcast network. It's family.